I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. It's President's Day, and today a look at presidential power, specifically the power to wage war and to conduct surveillance in the name of national security. Human rights lawyer and journalist Scott Horton argues that the president and an elite who determine America's national security policy are enjoying an unprecedented and unchecked level of power. Scott Horton joins us for the second hour. Up front, from public attitudes toward drug addiction to the cost of treating Lyme disease, a look at research from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Is legalized medical marijuana reducing prescription drug overdoses? How concerned are doctors about drug abuse, and what are they doing about it? Three researchers talk about their findings after the news from NPR. Hey, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks with you again, and I thank you for making Midday part of your day. It is President's Day. We're going to talk about presidential power in the second hour of our show today, specifically the president's power to wage wars around the world. Scott Horton, a very interesting man, a journalist and human rights attorney, has a new book out called The Lords of Secrecy, which looks into the surveillance state, the president's powers to wage wars, and how our government has treated whistleblowers, Edward Snowden and others who have exposed some government abuses. They'll be joining us in the second hour of the show today to talk about that subject. So that's Scott Horton. Mark him down. Should be an interesting topic for President's Day in the second hour of our show. From the stigma of drug addiction to the legalization of medical marijuana, in this hour, we're going to be taking a look at some new research out of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, a place that I have called one of the busiest in the universe, and of course located right here in Baltimore. So we've done this before, and today we'll have three guests talking about four different studies, including one that tracked the costs of treating people with Lyme disease. We'll be hearing about that a little bit later on in the show, and also another that measured how primary care doctors are responding to the problems associated with prescription pain medication. But up front, we meet Colleen Barry. Colleen Barry is an associate professor of health policy and management at Bloomberg, and she has two studies to share with us today. The first is on how people, how the public generally views those addicted to illegal drugs versus people who have mental health problems. Colleen Barry, nice to have you on the show. Thanks for visiting us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
That's an interesting study, an interesting subject to approach. Public attitudes toward people who have addictions versus public attitudes toward people who have been diagnosed with mental health problems, not drug addictions necessarily. So how'd you approach this, and why? Why were you interested in this question?
So first of all, in the area of healthcare integration, we are increasingly thinking about mental illness and drug abuse together in your insurance policy. Frequently, treatment for those two conditions are grouped together. And we have a lot of information about public attitudes with regard to mental illness, in particular in the context of recent mass shootings and other events that have been linked, at least in the public's perceptions and the news media, to mental illness. And so we were interested here in better understanding the public's attitudes toward addiction. The basic idea is that how the public thinks about public health issues is instrumentally important, I think, to the extent to which decision makers, politicians are paying attention to these issues and the types of policies we can ultimately pass to try to help people.
Hmm. How'd you go about this? How did you conduct a survey on that?
So we had a survey instrument that we fielded with a national sample of the American public. And what we did was we asked a series of different questions related to stigma, beliefs about the effectiveness of treatment, beliefs about whether it's okay to discriminate, and support for different public policies. And we asked those same items with half the sample specifying that an individual had mental illness, and the other half of the sample specifying that an individual had a drug addiction or history of drug addiction. And then we were able to directly compare public attitudes for these two conditions across these different domains.
That's interesting. There's no crime against mental illness. Mental illness happens to people.
Yep.
But there are crimes against drug addiction.
Absolutely.
Or actually not against the addiction, but the use of the drugs, which of course feed the addiction, illegal narcotics, for instance.
Absolutely. Yet we know from a healthcare standpoint that drug addiction is a medical condition. Someone becomes addicted, and to get well, you need to get access to some treatment. And increasingly in medicine, we're thinking about addiction as a chronic medical condition that's not so different from a condition like diabetes that can be responsive to treatment. Yet our hypothesis was that the public still tends to think of drug addiction as more of a moral failing. You did something wrong. Go out and
You're committing a crime, or you're by choice choosing to have this illness. Right?
Well, I think that not all drugs that individuals can get addicted to are illegal.
No, they're
so
not.
We see in this country an epidemic of prescription pain medication abuse. An individual can become addicted to prescription pain medications following pain that's chronic associated with a car accident or something else. And that type of activity can start out just as treatment for a chronic pain problem, and it can develop into an illegal activity.
So are people are generally more sympathetic toward a diagnosis of mental illness versus an addiction, even one that may result from abuse of pain medication that results from the scenario you just described, an accident or injury on the job or something?
Yep, absolutely. That's what we find in this study.
That people still regard drug addiction to be a moral failing.
That is what our results suggest. For example, the typical stigma measures that we look at in research relate to desire for social distance. Would you be willing or unwilling to have somebody with mental illness on the one hand or drug addiction on the other hand live next to you, work with you on a job, marry into your family? And we see much higher levels of social stigma toward people who have a history of drug addiction than people who have struggled with mental illness. And that's not to say that there is no stigma toward mental illness. There certainly is. But as a society, I think it's more it's easier in this day and age to admit to somebody, to a friend, even a coworker, that you're taking an antidepressant, that you're struggling with anxiety disorder. Stigma with regard to mental illness has changed pretty radically over the last 50 years, and we see very persistent levels of stigma toward addiction.
Well, the latter is a good thing. The former, not so good.
Exactly.
Because in Baltimore City, for instance, you know, drug addiction still remains a big problem. It's a source of a lot of the crime problems that we have had historically in Baltimore over the years. So can you tell from that? I'm very curious about this because, you know, we talk about the war on drugs. We've talked about it on this show. I've written about it. I hear from a lot of people who feel we've gone way overboard in prosecuting people who may be addicted to drugs and need medical care, treatment for their addiction, not incarceration. Can you tell from any of the surveys you've done or others have done where the public falls in that? Is it generally sympathetic toward that idea?
I think that from our work, we still see resistance on the part of the American public to the idea, A, that individuals are best served by getting themselves into treatment, so the stigma doesn't help.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, that treatment can work. We have a lot of good clinical evidence to suggest that if people can get into high-quality treatment for addiction, they can get well and live productive lives. But those aren't the images that we see in the popular media. And I think that if we saw more success stories of individuals that have been in treatment and have been able to be well-functioning, happy, marry, have kids, those kinds of stories could change people's perceptions about the effectiveness of treatment in getting people well.
Do people have a specific, or did you survey people on a specific attitude toward treatment, such as methadone, for instance, methadone for a heroin addiction? People very often say, well, That's not so good. You're just substituting one addiction for another. I don't understand why we give people methadone. I mean, I've heard this frequently from people.
Yeah, so I think that there's a low level of understanding related to the effectiveness of treatments like methadone or newer treatments like buprenorphine, Suboxone, that can be administered in primary care setting in a less stigmatized setting than has historically been the case for opiate treatment programs where people can get access to methadone. What we found in our study was that 60% of the American public didn't believe that there were effective treatments for drug addiction. And that's really a shame because we do have very effective treatments that are poorly understood. And I think also we have effective treatments that aren't available to all people in this country. Buprenorphine is very underused and poorly understood. And so I think one thing that we can do to make a difference is to make effective treatments more broadly available.
So what's your takeaway from this? And if you were in public policy, well, you are a public health policy. I mean, your takeaway would be we have more public education to do when it comes to the value of drug treatment, the possibilities in drug treatment. Bup, for instance, does not use the extent it could be. It was considered the next big thing just a few years ago. Is that your takeaway from it?
Two takeaways. The first is that we are in this era of great possibility with regard to the Affordable Care Act. The ACA is expanding treatment options, including for drug addiction, to many, many individuals that didn't have access to treatment before. And so this is an opportunity for us to really get good evidence-based treatments for drug addiction out there and for people to have insurance to be able to take advantage of those treatments. The other big lesson is that from a messaging standpoint, I think our research suggests that it's extraordinarily important to get out the story. That someone that's suffering from drug addiction can look just like you or me, and B, that those individuals can get well with effective treatment. Right now, the sort of street drug use stories that we see in our popular media and our news media aren't doing anything to get rid of the stigma that's associated with drug addiction, and that should change.
You know, the question I asked you the other day in an email, which might be a question for another day, I'd be curious about public attitudes toward those who have alcohol addiction,
yep,
who are alcoholics, versus those who are taking narcotics, illegal narcotics, and are addicted to heroin, for instance. Wonder what the difference in attitude is there.
Yeah, so we didn't look at it in this study. It's a great question. You pointed to one important difference, which is the illegality versus the legality of mm-hmm. the two different substances. And I think that there is a real under a low level of understanding for the dangers of alcohol and, in fact, the terrible impact that alcohol has on our society.
And the scope of that problem compared to the problem of heroin addiction, for instance.
Absolutely.
Colleen Barry is an associate professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And she's going to stay with us for the next segment of our show because she has more to tell us. Coming up, we're going to talk about another study. When you looked at medical marijuana and in states where it's legalized, and you also took a look at prescription drug overdoses in those same states. Some interesting results. We'll get more of that after this short break here on Midday. Colleen Barry with us. We have a couple other guests from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health joining us. One, Dr. Caleb Alexander. He'll be joining us. He's the co-director of the Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness. He'll be coming right up. And we also have another study to tell you about, the costs of treating people with Lyme disease in the U.S. All that in this hour of Midday. Dan Roderick's here. Short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here again. In this hour of the show, four studies from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. We were just speaking with Colleen Barry about one study she did on public attitudes toward people with drug addictions. She's an associate professor of health policy and management at Bloomberg. Now we're going to turn to another study that Colleen worked on. This has to do with medical marijuana and prescription drug overdoses. Another interesting question. People who in states where this is legalized, where medical marijuana is legalized, are we seeing any harm reduction from these other problems, a growing problem of prescription drug overdoses, or, of course, abuse and overdoses, right?
Yep. So prescription pain medication overdoses has become a national epidemic in this country. Over the last 15 years, the rates of overdose deaths have tripled. This problem is now on par with motor vehicle accidents in terms of unintentional death, accident death. And so many individuals who receive these narcotic pain medications to manage their chronic pain could potentially get medical marijuana in states where it's legal as an alternative to pain management. So in our study, we were interested in looking at whether in states that had passed medical marijuana laws, you would see lower rates of prescription pain medication overdose deaths that potentially could be attributed to the medical marijuana laws.
Let me just add a few facts to what you just shared with us, Colleen. According to the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, we call it the CDC. It's actually the CDC&P.
Mm-hmm.
Drug overdose death rates in the U.S. have more than tripled since 1990 and have never been higher. The clinical use of prescription opioids nearly doubled between 2000 and 2010.
Yep.
And in 2010, more than 38,000 people died from drug overdoses of all kinds, with many of these deaths caused by those prescription opioids. We're going to talk about those in a little bit here, but more from your study. So we had three states that legalized marijuana for medical uses prior to 1999. Those were California, Oregon, and Washington.
Yep.
But it goes on from there, right? There are other states that have legalized this.
Yep. A bunch of states, 23 states in the District of Columbia at this point, have medical marijuana laws on the books. And so what we did was we used death certificate data from the Centers for Disease Control. And using that data, we found that the rate of prescription painkiller overdoses, as you said, has increased in all states over our 12-year study period, which was from 1999 through 2010. However, the rate of opiate painkiller overdose deaths in states with medical marijuana laws was about 25% lower on average than the rate in states without these laws. And in absolute terms, this is pretty sizable. States with medical marijuana laws had 1,700 fewer opiate painkiller overdose deaths in 2010 alone than we would have expected based on the trends in those states before those laws were passed.
Based on the trends that were there in place.
Yep.
Okay. That's interesting. And this is a problem that was growing, too, during this period, right?
Yep. So we saw a slowing of the growth.
Yeah, in those states. Mm-hmm. In all those states and the district?
We didn't look at the district specifically, but in the states that had passed laws.
Okay. So you're very careful the way that studies are worded, the summaries of studies are worded to say, you know, this is there may be a correlation here. It strongly suggests that there is.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, isolating the effect of laws on health is notoriously difficult.
Yeah,
states that will pass medical marijuanas will probably look different from states that don't pass those types of laws. And so it's important to try to take that into account in empirical analyses to try to isolate the effects of laws. So we do a whole host of things to try to get at that, including controlling for other different policies that states might be passing that would have a separate effect on overdose death rates, like passage of prescription drug monitoring programs, cracking down on pill mills, those types of policies. And once we take those other factors into account, as well as changing trends in the states and policy at the federal level, we see that there is this effect. Obviously, it's critical in all research to study an important research question using a variety of different data sources in lots of different ways. And I think the ideal study here would follow individuals with opiate addiction both before and after a medical marijuana law occurred.
Right.
And then look what happened. But those studies are very hard to do. And so I think that this approach is important to try to identify some promising areas for policy change. And what we find is that medical marijuana laws appear to provide an alternative for the management of chronic debilitating pain. What we don't understand is what is going on sort of underneath that.
Right.
Are people completely substituting off painkillers like Vicodin or OxyContin.
For marijuana.
Yeah, are they supplementing? Mm-hmm. A study like this can't really answer those types of questions, unfortunately, but it's critical to understand sort of who can benefit most from these laws, I think.
I'm going to give the phone number here for Midday. Our lines are open. It's a live show here in this hour of our show. If you have any comments or questions for our guest or our guest when our next guest joins us, 410-662-8780 is our number here for Midday. Toll-free long distance is 866-661-9309. I already have an email from someone who remembers our email address. Mm-hmm. It's midday@wypr.org. Another interesting aspect of this, 9 in 10 primary care doctors report that prescription drug abuse is a problem in their communities. The question is, are they responding to that? Are they doing something about it? Caleb Alexander is with us now. Dr. Alexander is an epidemiologist at Hopkins, and he is co-director of the Center at Hopkins for Drug Safety and Effectiveness, which has been around for a couple of years. Nice to have you on the show, Dr. Alexander.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So your study, you were looking at how doctors are responding to this problem that we were just describing with Colleen here.
Yeah, that's right. Primary care physicians in particular play such an important role in overseeing the care of many patients with acute and chronic pain, and we wanted to understand better their beliefs and attitudes and experiences with respect to the prescription drug abuse epidemic generally, and also more specifically with respect to the potential safety and effectiveness of prescription opioids.
You know, we've discussed this on the show. We've had some firsthand stories told to us, related to us. A middle-aged man who struggled with alcohol and heroin over the course of his lifetime, to a young man in his 20s who had a heroin problem, thought he licked it, and started using pain medication again because of an injury that he had in his early 20s and ended up going back on heroin. We've heard some really harrowing stories here. I'm sure these doctors have heard them too, right?
Yeah, I have a clinical practice myself. I'm a general internist, and I can tell you both through my own work as well as doing research in this area, the stories are compelling and varied in terms of the ways that people are initially exposed to prescription opioids. A fellow that had lower back pain and acute pain turned into chronic pain, and ultimately the fellow died from an overdose. Mm. Individuals who are treated initially by very well-intending physicians trying to help patients manage their pain. The statistics are staggering. Enough opioids were dispensed a few years ago to supply every adult in the United States a continuous month-long supply of Vicodin. I mean, just stunning. I think it's worth asking, how did we get to a point where by the time this very program is finished, another person in the United States will have succumbed from prescription opioids?
How did we get here?
Well,
what do you think is behind that?
Yeah, there are a lot of different factors that have contributed to this epidemic and really made this the perfect storm. Historically, as a clinical community, we've done poorly treating pain, and there have been very well-intended efforts to try to improve the identification and management of patients in pain. To some degree, I think that these have backfired. I think that as a clinical community, many clinicians such as myself historically may have underestimated the potential risks of opioids. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was in clinical training in residency and internal medicine, we were routinely taught that if a patient had true pain, organic pain, if they had a true basis for their pain, that one need not worry about the potential addictive potential of opioids. And that's just flat out wrong. So I think that many providers, many prescribers may tend to overestimate the effectiveness of these medicines and underestimate their risks.
Prior to the show today, we received an email from someone who said that he feels that doctors are under a lot of pressure to prescribe these medications from their patients. The patients demand them. The patients say they're in pain, and doctors sympathize.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's hard to I wouldn't want to overgeneralize regarding patterns of care, but I will say that there are plenty of patients that suffer tremendously from pain. I think one of the important messages from our study and this opportunity is to emphasize that there are many different tools in the toolbox. We already heard from Colleen Berry about the effectiveness and underutilization of treatments for opioid dependency. The bottom line is that there are many different treatments that can be used for to manage acute and chronic pain. And I'm referring both to other drugs, other prescription and over-the-counter medicines, but also non-pharmacologic therapies, non-drug treatments such as physical therapy or acupuncture or massage.
Now, your study, you're looking at what's going on with doctors, and I mentioned that 9 in 10 of them say that they recognize that this is a moderate or a big problem in their own communities that they're serving where they are doctors. But half of them say they're less likely to prescribe these painkillers compared to just a year ago.
Yeah, this was probably the finding that we were most surprised by and most heartened by, frankly, that nearly half of physicians reported that they were less likely to prescribe these products than a year ago. And now keep in mind, this was a survey, and as with any study, it's important that additional ways of looking at the research question are undertaken. And in fact, there was, within the past few weeks, a very interesting paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine that used a different source of data, that actually used prescription claims and also suggested that we may be at an inflection point. That is, that we may actually be finally seeing reductions in the rates of use of these medicines.
There'd be two things going on there. Doctors more aware of the problem, and patients or their families more aware of it, too.
I mean, there's a lot.
Afraid of becoming addicted, going down that hole.
I think so. I mean, there's a lot of different sources of information and many different drivers of physicians' prescribing patterns, ranging from their own clinical experiences to the effects of media and scientific publications and changing practice guidelines and the like. But, you know, I think that we may actually be at a turning point and reaching an inflection point. It's important to emphasize that the rates of injuries and deaths from these products have increased lockstep with the sales of these products. That is, that there's a direct correlation and a strong one between the sales of these products and all of the injuries and deaths that we're talking about.
You know, back to the point one of our listeners made in that email that I mentioned to you. The other day we were talking about the shortage in primary care doctors and how they just don't, you know, they just don't feel like those who are in primary care don't feel like they spend enough time with their patients, really get to know them. There's a lot of pressure there, and this could be part of the result of it.
Yeah,
not the good news you're reporting, the problem prior to it.
Sure, sure. Well, I think that clinicians, I certainly in my own practice, have struggled with how to best manage patients' pain. And many patients do have expectations to receive a treatment for pain when it's present. I think all too often as clinicians and indeed as patients that we may expect for pain to be completely eliminated rather than recognize that in many cases it's about managing the pain, mm-hmm. about minimizing the pain and importantly minimizing the disruption that the pain poses on our quality of life and our ability to engage with our communities and our families and the like.
Sounds to me, Dr. Alexander, you got to get with Colleen Berry here and combine a study to take a look at whether some of these doctors are now suggesting medical marijuana. I don't know where all these doctors are, but in states where that's legal, right? Some of them are recommending it as a way to avoid the opioid problem?
We don't know. We know that some people are using medical marijuana. In fact, in states where this is legal, chronic and debilitating pain is the number one indication that is recorded for why people are getting medical marijuana. What we don't know is what that looks like in terms of the relationship with the physician. We don't know how effective it is. We don't know which individuals medical marijuana can be helpful for which diagnoses. There is a lot that we don't know in this area. And science has gotten behind, I would say, sort of the legal movement here. And I think it's time for us to catch up in terms of collecting more information on what people are doing, what physicians' opinions are on these issues, and what works best.
Santosh was giving us a ring to ask about medical marijuana. Santosh, go right ahead with your question.
Good afternoon. First of all, thank you very much for having me here. Sure. My question is, being that there's so much mounting evidence that medical marijuana is good, and also, you know, we saw a few months ago the show on CNN by Sanjay Gupta. Why is it taking so long to legalize medical marijuana?
Well, I think actually the pace of change has been quite rapid. We have 23 states in the District of Columbia that now have these laws on the books, and a number of states, Pennsylvania, for example, considering legislation in this current session. So I think times are changing quite rapidly with medical marijuana and also, frankly, with broader legalization efforts.
Dr. Alexander, back to you, a question about physicians. In your study, 88% of them expressed confidence in their own ability to prescribe opioids appropriately. What do you think of that?
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Well, it is interesting. And, I'll say physicians tend to be confident people.
Yeah, it's interesting.
You know, I think despite all their dangers, and they do have many that we've discussed, opioids still play an important role in providing pain to some patients. There's some interesting evidence from examining physicians' interactions with the pharmaceutical industry, with drug companies, that the majority of physicians believe that they are not prone to influence, to being influenced by interacting with drug companies, and yet most think that their peers are prone to such influences. So, so I think that this confidence may reflect a combination of the fact that clinicians are generally well-trained and tend to be pretty confident people, and also, that clinicians may tend to overestimate the effectiveness of these medicines and underestimate their risks. But this was a one-time survey, and we really can't know for sure what underlies these high rates of confidence with these products.
The takeaway is that something's happening there in terms of attitudes, public awareness, and certainly awareness among primary care physicians about the problem.
Yeah, that's for sure, and that there are many different treatment alternatives than prescription opioids, and that this type of study will be important to complement by other studies using other data sources, such as prescription records, in order to examine ongoing changes in this dynamic area.
Maybe it's self-described by its title, the Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness, but just it's been operating for a couple of years now, 3 years at Hopkins?
That's right. Yeah, we launched in late 2012 and have been running ever since.
Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, Dr. Caleb Alexander from Johns Hopkins, the Bloomberg School of Public Health, where he co-directs the Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness. And Colleen Barry, from the same institution, thank you for being here today and sharing the results of your studies with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Stay with us, folks. More to come here. New data on Lyme disease treatment and what it's costing the U.S. healthcare system. That's coming up after this short break on Midday. Yeah, I called it one of the busiest places in the universe, the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, because we're always discovering new research being done there, new work, new efforts, all kinds of things, and new people all the time. So we invite them here on Midday because the work is so interesting, and they're right across town there in East Baltimore at the School of Public Health. Now we're joined by Emily Adrian, who's a PhD candidate in health policy and management at Bloomberg. Emily, nice to have you on the show. Thanks for visiting us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You've been working on, this is very interesting, Lyme disease and the treatment for Lyme disease and what it's costing the U.S. healthcare system.
Right.
And so has anyone ever explored this before to actually see what the cost of this is?
So there are a few studies, mainly in Western Europe, and there are a few sort of local studies around here, but mainly they relied on chart reviews and, you know, so they're really small-scale studies. Nobody's looked at it, on a sort of a population basis.
And you look at this pretty comprehensively. So what got you to this subject, though, this assignment?
Well, you know, I work on healthcare costs, broadly speaking, and my co-author, John Aucott, is, you know, sort of a leading expert in the country on Lyme disease, a medical doctor. And so, we got involved in this project together, and, you know, Lyme disease is really controversial. It's an exciting topic. I think it was hard to resist.
Yeah, believe me, I know it's controversial. We've hosted a couple of shows on this topic here. So tell us what you found, first of all. First of all, how did you find it? People assume, well, we know what that costs, but how do you go about finding out what a specific diagnosis costs?
Well, so we use medical...
In terms of treatment, right?
Right. So yeah. We use medical claims data, which is basically billing information that's, healthcare providers submit to insurance companies. So it's, pretty much shows us what people sought treatment for and, you know, how much it cost, how much the insurance company paid for it. So we looked at this medical claims data for 2006 through 2010 for about 52,000 people who received antibiotic treatment within 30 days of a Lyme disease test order or diagnosis. So, you know, we were really looking for a very specific case definition of Lyme disease. We couldn't do chart reviews on 52,000 people, so that's just not realistic.
Mm-hmm.
So we were doing our best to sort of lock down this group of Lyme disease cases.
And what kind of a number did you come up with?
So we have...
What did you calculate the cost to be?
So we found that... We had a control group, which was about 260,000 people who were really similar, matched controls, similar in many dimensions to the Lyme disease cases, except that they had no evidence of Lyme disease exposure. So looking at these two groups, we found that having Lyme disease resulted in about $3,000 more in healthcare costs per year as compared to similar people who didn't have any evidence of Lyme disease exposure.
And from that, you extrapolate out an estimate of a range here that could be up to $1.3 billion a year?
Right. So there are recent estimates. I think 2 years ago, the CDC said that, you know, there were approximately 300,000 people who end up with Lyme disease a year. And last year, there was a study that said the range was about 240,000 to 440,000. So it's a huge range. And so when you look at $3,000, it doesn't seem like a huge healthcare cost. But when you look at the sort of how many people this is affecting, it ends up being a really big number.
You know, this is really interesting to me, that number, 240,000 to 440,000 new cases of this tick-borne illness diagnosed each year. So actually diagnosed?
Diagnosed, yeah.
Okay. So what does that tell you? What does the research show on the growing numbers? I hear all kinds of different things. A couple of tweets today from our listeners saying, well, the tick is more widespread than believed to have been. It's spreading across the country.
Right. So I think that's what's thought to be happening. Obviously, our study was looking at costs, not looking at, you know, how widespread this is. But, mm-hmm. you know, from the research that I've done the research that I've looked at, it really shows that, you know, increasing deer populations, you know, reforestation, which is great, but leads to more ticks being present and people living closer to forests and just generally being more exposed to ticks is part of the problem. Climate change. There are a lot of reasons why it's on the increase.
Now, Emily, you're also familiar with the controversy just from reading about Lyme disease.
Yeah.
I know you are. I know you are. And the controversy seems to be between infectious disease experts and people who suffer from Lyme disease and also and the so-called Lyme-literate physicians
right.
who are out there, that this is not a chronic disease and that people are overprescribed antibiotics in long-term regimens.
Right. So I think there's sort of a whole spectrum of thought on this. And I think, you know, the basic idea is that there's no blood test for post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome. That's what the CDC calls it.
Yeah, by the way, that's PTLDS, right?
Yes.
Post, referring to that as post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome.
Right, which is sort of when, you know, a group. It's sort of the group of patients who, after they've been treated for Lyme disease with antibiotics, have lingering symptoms of fatigue and pain and, you know, cognitive problems.
Mm-hmm.
So the CDC calls that post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome. But, you know, there's this whole range of opinions on what's happening. You know, on one end of the spectrum, there are some doctors that believe that just sort of the aches and pains of life or patients are depressed and it's not really a disease or anything like that.
It's not chronic.
It's not chronic. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the whole other end of the spectrum is people who call it chronic Lyme disease and believe that it, you know, reflects persistent infection with the bacteria. And so, you know, people feel very passionate about their opinions on this, either, you know, regardless of what side they're on. So I think because of that, there actually hasn't been a lot of research done. It's a really touchy area, and people are sort of afraid to come down on one side or the other. So I think, you know, our study was really an attempt to move past that debate and really look at what the numbers are telling us about what's happening to patients and what sort of care they're getting.
So when we talk about post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome, okay, those are any of those persistent symptoms that people have that they believe or their doctor believes is related to Lyme disease, do you know?
Well, so I think, you know, the CDC says that this is a real thing. So I think it's time that we sort of come to accept that, you know, something is happening to these patients. They're genuinely suffering. Hmm. So, you know, I think, you know.
Okay. So that's there. So there's this PTLDS that is recognized by the CDC.
Right.
Okay. So can you tell from your study, the numbers that you put together, when you're looking at $3,000 per patient on average more, right, than someone who is not diagnosed with this, that that's the primary diagnosis that you tracked, or were there some other problems that the person had?
Well, so we were looking at just healthcare costs as compared to similar people who had no Lyme disease exposure. So these are total healthcare costs over the year. But we did control for 44 other high cost conditions. So, you know, things that would have driven costs like cancer, you know, weren't, you know, we eliminated those. So this is doesn't have to do with that or anything. So we're really trying to narrow it down to, you know, the actual effects of Lyme disease.
So what's the takeaway from this study then? Given that there's a controversy, you know, and there's some infectious disease experts will hear this and say, hear the results of your study and say, well, we're paying too much because people attribute all kinds of maladies to Lyme disease, which may not be the case. But so the takeaway is that we what need to be more sympathetic to that. We need the science needs to listen to the patients more.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think what the data is showing is that you know, people are going back to the doctor, and doctors are trying to help them. They're doing their job. They're trying to run more tests and find out what's going on. And you know, because there's you know no evidence base for this, and there's no you know systematic you know treatment for doctors to follow with these patients. They're sort of lost, and they end up, you know, getting, you know, repeated tests and, you know, going to, a, you know, see the doctor more often than they otherwise would. And so I think really increased awareness about, you know, the long-term complications or, you know, the potential for lingering symptoms among physicians, particularly primary care physicians, is really essential.
So people may be prescribed antibiotics in the long-term. That could be one of the costs. It could also be painkillers. You don't know. You didn't break it down that far, right?
So we did.
Did you? Know, oh, I'm sorry.
we did look at, so among the people with Lyme disease, the ones who had at least one long-term symptom cost about $4,000 more than the people with Lyme disease who didn't have a long-term symptom. So that's on top of the $3,000 that we already discussed. So, you know, it's a lot of money, but we didn't find, you know, I think one of the concerns about our study was that, you know, we were capturing these people who maybe didn't have Lyme disease, but whose doctors were treating them with, you know, long-term IV antibiotics. Hmm. But we didn't really find that that was the case. The IV antibiotic prescriptions weren't significantly costly in our study, which indicates that it probably wasn't happening.
I'm trying to figure out exactly what the takeaway of your study is. I'm glad you did this, actually calculate the costs. It come within a range of some kind on what this is costing us. But what do you do with that information? You know, when you're looking at public health policy, do you say, doctors, you better listen to patients more? Or whatever it is, Lyme disease or whatever, people are suffering these particular maladies, fatigue, muscle pain, aches and pains, various aches and pains, similar to arthritis, as it's been described, and some memory problems. I've heard people describe that as well.
Yeah, so I think, you know, when it's caught early, Lyme disease is sort of viewed as a really simple, easy-to-treat infection. You know, one doctor's office visit and a cheap prescription for antibiotics, usually about $100 for all of that. You know, that's what's, like, thought about Lyme disease, but
well, that's what mainstream medicine says ought to be done, right?
Exactly.
When I say mainstream medicine, I mean like Infectious Disease Society of America, right?
They don't recommend any follow-up visits or anything like that. So I think our study was really driving home the fact that, you know, this maybe isn't as straightforward or simple as it seems. So, you know, there are a lot more work needs to be done in this area, and certainly clinicians need to be more aware that, you know, there are potential long-term complications that, you know, can be costly, and managing the costs of those. And
this is really interesting. Have you heard since the study was published, or from infectious disease experts at Hopkins or anybody who said, you know, I understand what you did here. I'm glad you did this, but, you know, it's not going to change the science on Lyme disease.
Sure. I think, you know, again, people feel really passionately on all sides of this debate. But, you know, I think that just sort of underlines the need for more research and for, you know, continued funding in this area for people to keep doing work to see what's really happening with post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome.
What happens next? When you do a study like this, I'm always curious where you move to next. You're a PhD candidate. Is this your major work toward a PhD at Hopkins?
This is not, actually. This isn't my dissertation. But my dissertation is, you know, sort of focused broadly on healthcare costs. So it's very related. You know, I think there's so much more to be done in this area, looking beyond 12-month healthcare costs to see, you know, how long these symptoms linger and how much it costs over time, and healthcare utilization over time is really important.
There's still a mystery here. And people who are infected with Lyme disease, who had the bite or someone in their family, I've talked to many of them. they're convinced that this is a long-term thing, that it doesn't go away even in 30 days or 60 days, that it persists.
Right. And people are genuinely suffering, and I think that's an important thing to recognize. You know, and our numbers are showing that it's not as simple and easy to treat as it seems. So I think, you know, obviously something's going on.
If you were to break it down further, actually, I don't know how you could do this, because some of those, you know, some of the symptoms you described, fibromyalgia, right?
Right.
Fatigue, these are things that just... It could be chronic fatigue syndrome because you don't get enough sleep. It could be related to mental illness, a depression of some kind. It's hard to break it down further, isn't it? You'd really need to crunch numbers on that. You'd have to look at individual cases, wouldn't you?
Right. I mean, I think it's really difficult. These symptoms are, you know, quite general. They overlap with a lot of other diagnoses. So I think, you know, that's really... you know, why some people don't actually believe that it's real.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think more research needs to be done to see if there's a way to sort of pin this down. You know, doctors don't want to be in a position where they don't know what to tell their patients, you know, that they don't know what's happening to their patients. They want to be able to help. But
exactly. They want to provide an answer.
Yeah.
And people demand answers.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
They need answers.
Is there any reluctance on the part of insurance companies to cover any of these costs? Do you know about that? Because there is a controversy, right? And actually, there have been some doctors in the United States prosecuted for over-prescribing medications for Lyme patients.
Right. Being on long-term antibiotics can be really dangerous.
Yeah.
So I know that, you know, there have been lawsuits about, you know, doctors putting patients on IV antibiotics for a long time. And, you know, I think...
Well, some doctors have lost licenses in I think, New York or Connecticut for doing this.
Maybe New York had some law recently passed that said that, you know, doctors were protected, or there was a proposed law or something.
I was wondering if it affects actually insurance coverage for people who make this claim that they need, you know, more long-term treatment.
You know, I'm not sure, but I do know that our study got some attention from AHIP, which is the America's Health Insurance Plans, the health insurance sort of lobbying group. And I imagine because they, you know, they obviously want to keep costs down, and they're seeing that, you know, this is costing more than it should.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And that you say the CDC does recognize the PTLDS.
They do. Yeah. If you look on their website, they, you know, they recognize it as something that's happening.
Was there any geography to your study?
Yeah. So Lyme disease is, you know, really common in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic, and then sort of the Great Lakes region, Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Huh.
But otherwise, you know, it's found across the country, but, you know, really 95% of the cases are in those three regions.
Is it growing? I mean, spreading, I guess, is the word. Because that's the claim. I mentioned this to you earlier. Can you tell from your study or other studies whether that...
So we can't tell from our study, but I think, you know, it does seem to be spreading from the literature that I've read. And, you know, John Alcott, my co-author, also has seen, you know, increasing number of patients each year coming into his clinic with Lyme disease. So, you know, it's on the increase. And given these costs, I think that's, you know.
John Alcott, AUCOTT, Dr. Alcott.
Dr. Alcott.
He worked with you on this. He was actually the lead author.
Mm-hmm.
He's an assistant professor of rheumatology at Hopkins in the School of Medicine.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And you're at Bloomberg. And how close are you to, you know, getting a PhD?
My favorite question. So I'm a couple months away, I guess.
All right.
May.
Emily Adrian. And a PhD candidate in health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And we've been examining some of the studies, four studies that were done by staff and faculty at Bloomberg in this hour of midday. I hope you enjoyed that. Emily, thank you very much for this.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and congratulations on finally getting a number attached to the treatments for Lyme disease in the U.S.
Thanks.
So we'll do this again another time. Lots of good research coming out of Hopkins and the Bloomberg School, so we will... revisit other studies in the future. We'll visit studies in the future on this show with this format. I hope you enjoyed it. That's our first hour of midday. I hope you enjoyed the first hour. Please stick around. It's President's Day, and we're going to be talking about presidential power, specifically the presidential power to wage wars around the world. Scott Horton joining us, author of Lords of Secrecy, a new book about national security and America's stealth warfare. We'll take a break here for lunch, brought to us on Mondays by Rossina Gourmet. Since 1999, Rossina Gourmet has served handmade, locally sourced ingredients for their sandwiches, soups, salads, and vegetarian items. Rosina Gourmet is located in Canton. It's in downtown Baltimore and also at Harbor East. Catering is available by visiting rosinagourmet.com. Please stay tuned for the news and stick around for the second hour of our show.